Been a hot minute since my last Trapcast, hasn't it? You know what? I really wanted to do so many more episodes since I started this last year, but I got incredibly busy during the second half of 2019, and that kind of rolled into the early days of 2020, and it's actually still kind of going on. And they were all good things, definitely, but I had to put a lot of the fun stuff to the side. I will say another project I was working on for my blog had to get put on hold too. You know, I'm going to mention some things about that at the end of this episode, partially because it actually ties into what we're talking about, but also I'm kind of hoping it will entice me to start doing that again. So let's see, fingers crossed, right? Despite being AWOL for a few months, I have been watching Trapper John, sometimes skipping around to newer episodes, newer being 35 years old instead of 38 years old, something like that. And sometimes I watch the early ones. I guess I've seen the next two episodes I'm going to talk about probably three times each. I think they're both really good, and they offer early glimpses into what will become staples of the show. For one, we're going to get a little intro into Jackpot's background, finally, so we can see he's becoming more important to the series. I will tell you, Jackpot was played by Brian Stokes Mitchell, and I do believe he's more of a theater guy, but this was really my intro to him, and I think Jackpot is a really great character, one of my favorites. I probably won't go too heavily into Mitchell. Matter of fact, I know I'm not going to do that in this episode because, I have to really space things out. And he's had a really interesting career as far as I can tell from what I've researched. So I would definitely like to wait for a more Jackpot-centric episode to really dive into Brian Stokes Mitchell's career. Another staple is we're beginning to see that this is a softer version of the series, which is a lot different from the pilot. And number three, we're also seeing the softer side of Dr. Riverside. He has yet to become, quote unquote, one of the guys, but I think episode four is a good indicator of things that the writers had in mind and that would stick later on as the show progressed. We're also heading into really awesome guest star territory. Both these episodes feature dynamic and wonderful actors, and I was really thrilled to see a great early performance from an up-and-comer who I'll talk about in the second episode I'm covering tonight. And OMG, guys, there's a ton of reverse psychology happening in episode four. I mean, there's so much they should have just titled it Reverse Psychology. Anyway, I should probably give you the titles of the episodes that we're covering tonight. I keep saying tonight because it is night here. I don't know when you're listening, but it's very moody in my office. I'm feeling kind of into it. It's Friday night, having a drink. Anyway, Trapper John episode four is titled Love is a Three-Way Street. It's really, really good, and one that I kind of enjoy revisiting time and time again. The fifth episode is titled Shattered Image. Not quite as strong as episode four, but there's a lot to like about it. So let's just get started. Okay, so again, episode four is titled Love is a Three-Way Street. It originally aired on October 21st, 1979. Here's the synopsis. Trapper's ex-wife Melanie, played by Jessica Walter, has a new beau named Beaumont, played by the great and glorious Monty Markham. He's experiencing some troublesome heart issues and ends up at San Francisco Memorial Hospital with Trapper John as his doctor. So Melanie had been contemplating marrying Beaumont, but still feels deeply connected to Trapper and is confused about what the proper decision should be. This also places Trapper into the quandary because he feels like he's too personally invested in the patient's relationship with his ex-wife. Beaumont, by the way, is almost too good to be true. He's a bit of a narcissist, but he's also extremely charming and really supportive of having Trapper as his doctor. Not really worried about Melanie's feelings for him.
Well, well. Old Trapper John. You know, Melanie's told me so much about you, I feel like we're old buddies.
Yeah, well, she asked me to look in on you.
Now, listen, no offense to the young man here, but if you'd like to take over my case, I'd be tickled to death to let you do it.
Well, we'll talk about that after you've completed your tests.
Well, don't worry about old Harry. This thing isn't going to slow me down. Not when there's a beautiful woman like Melanie out there just waiting to get married.
Yeah, I know.
You know, we postponed the wedding once. I don't want Melanie to be disappointed again.
Right.
Excuse me, Mr. Beaumont. We better let you get some rest.
Why? I feel great.
We want to keep it that way, right, Doctor?
Right.
But of course, Beaumont's stay in the hospital inevitably brings Melanie closer to Trapper. So while all this is going on, Dr. Riverside has become frustrated with Gonzo's eyesore of an RV, the Titanic, right? And he keeps threatening to have it removed.
Gates, what are you doing with this gurney?
You know, Stanley, tradesmen are impossible these days. In spite of my explicit instructions, they delivered my wine to the hospital instead of Chateau Neuf du Pape.
76?
That's a good year.
Since when, Doctor, do we transport wine with hospital gurney?
I had to, Stanley. All the wheelchairs were full.
Hand me those bottles, will you?
You seem to go out of your way to destroy the decorum of this hospital.
Well, if I don't, who will?
Well, it's got to stop, Gates. This Titanic business, for example. I've been discussing this at great length with my father. He's chairman of the board, you know.
Yes, you've mentioned it from time to time.
Now, this thing that you live in has got to be removed immediately.
Can't do it, Stanley. Any movement right now might bruise the wine. This is very delicate stuff.
You don't seem to be listening to me.
Are you going into the hospital?
Of course.
Well, take this gurney with you. I'm through with it.
Gates! You remove this eyesore once or I'll throw it away myself!
And jackpot, finally getting that story that I mentioned, aids an injured gang member from his part of town, which, as you probably could guess, if we're talking about his part of town, it must be the bad part of town. That gang member, not the brightest bulb on the tree.
Right. Now, I'll take that.
What, this?
Yeah, yeah, come on, quick, put it in the sling. Come on.
What are you going to do with it?
I'm going to get rich, baby. You know what this stuff's worth on the street?
That's just...
Hey, what's in the paper bag there?
It's my lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, sure.
It really
come
is.
Come on, in it goes. One word, one sound out of you, I'll be back, and I'll carve my name in your face.
Kid's a little weird.
Why?
He just stole a tuna fish sandwich and a bottle of suppositories.
But he's not done with the hospital yet. Dot, dot, dot. All three stories actually really beautifully collide when Beaumont needs major surgery, but his x-rays are in the Titanic. Because, I mean, why not? And the Titanic, dun, 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 has been stolen by guess who? Will they get the test results back in time to save Beaumont? Or is he better off dead so Trapper can have his woman back? This is such a fun episode. Despite Beaumont having a pretty serious heart condition, the whole thing is so lighthearted, and Markham playing Beaumont with so much snarky charm, it's just impossible not to smile when he's on screen. There may as well not even be another person in the room when Beaumont's around. And I think this episode also gives us a better glimpse into Melanie's life. There's some cute jokes about her divorce from Trapper, and the two have a really, really nice chemistry. But also one of Melanie's biggest issues was that when she was married to Trapper is that she was a housewife and a mother. And I don't think she felt like she had her own identity, which I think led to some of their marital problems. So after the divorce, she ended up becoming a fashion buyer for a department store. And, you know, Melanie is really serious about her job. And this ends up putting her up against a new set of odds with Trapper, as they are both so dedicated to their work that there's very little time for romance or anything else. You can tell that they still really love each other. It just seemed that they seem much better as friends who sometimes may or may not share a few benefits. The ending of this episode, where they schedule a booty call only to be cock-blocked by Trap's beeper, is a really great way to end the story. It's really charming and cute. In terms of the gang members, I would say that that's an inconsequential storyline, except that we finally get to see a bit more Jackpot, and the reverse psychology on the gang is actually really amusing.
Yeah, man? Are you accusing me of heisting the old crank? Yeah!
No. No. I think you're too smart for that, Paula. But you probably know the morons who did steal it.
What do you mean, morons?
I just hope they're not friends of yours, because when they find out what they've got...
Gonzo.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm awfully glad they took it off our hands.
Yeah? What's the matter with it?
Well, I shouldn't be telling you this, but...
Gonzo.
Why not? These guys would understand.
Yeah, but what about the health department? And the big dudes in Washington, you think they'd understand? Uh-uh. And if the FAPCNR ever found out we've been talking...
Hey, man, what is this, FAPC thing? What is that?
It's a Federal Association for the Protection of Classified Nuclear Radioactivity.
Gonzo!
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry, fellas, I can't talk about it. But listen, those guys with the Titanic... Have you noticed their hair falling out, anything?
Oh, that wouldn't happen that fast.
Well, maybe not right away, but the impotence might.
Impotence?
Sterility, too. Starts with a rash, you know, itchy skin.
A few scabs here and there.
But it's not your problem, right? Just be glad you're not involved. We gotta run, Jeff.
Right. Those poor jerks. I wonder how they're gonna look.
I love how Jackpot just follows Gonzo's lead without missing a beat. And I mention this not just because of the trope of reverse psychology, but also because I think we can see there's a real friendship with the characters who seem to know each other well and play off each other very naturally. They come across as real friends, which I love. Also, the gang member story kind of allows the audience to start to see Riverside as maybe a better guy. Yes, he's full of hot air, but he's not bad. When Gonzo first thinks Riverside had the van towed, Riverside is genuinely horrified at the idea that Gonzo thought that he'd actually do it. He's a lot of talk, likes to complain, he openly hates the Titanic, but he's not a louse. He's a good guy, guys. Let's keep him around for the next 140-something episodes, okay? Can we? So Jessica Walter, who plays Melanie, appears in the pilot, but I didn't really mention her, mostly because I think that her role in the pilot is pretty thankless. But here we're getting a better picture of both Melanie and her relationship with Trapper. There's one episode in particular where I'm thinking I want to dedicate a bit more time to Walter, so I'll just briefly say that she was pretty much a stalwart at this stage. I guess at the time Trapper John was on the air, she was probably most famous for playing the psychotic ex to Clint Eastwood's DJ in Play Misty for Me. But she's been in a number of memorable things and, of course, still works. I guess most recently you would recognize her from Arrested Development. But my favorite role of hers will always be as Mr. Bradford's ex on Three's a Crowd, which was the spinoff to Three's Company. Oh, she was such a great adversary to James Bradford, played by one of my all-time favorite actors, Robert Mandan, who, by the way, I saw appeared in a fifth season episode of Trapper John, which is something to look forward to. I can't wait. Anyway. Walter is just ridiculously elegant and plays such a likable role here as Melanie. She's always a treat to watch, and I love that her character grows as a person, even right from the start. So Melanie finds herself in the position that so many women in the late 70s were finding themselves in, right? There was a chance to have other roles aside from being a mother and a wife, and Melanie embraces that chance to have a late start in her career. And yes, it's working and selling sportswear, but I think retail provided a great place for people without a lot of job experience to find a place that offers real responsibility and challenges. I still find that true today, even though we're seeing sort of the retail world close up with online shopping and things like that. And it kind of bums me out in a way, because I know retail was kind of a safe haven for me in my early days when there was no other job I was going to get. And also, I believe that she was promoted to buyer somewhere here at the beginning of the series, which I love. So we do see that she's really serious about her job, and I love it. And, you know, this is just a lot of fun in this episode, but it's also dealing with real life issues, such as balancing that home and work life, and also finding happiness after divorce. So it's really got a lot of great things happening in it. But, as I said before, we've also got Monty Markham. He's one of my all-time favorite character actors. He's so versatile, and he always carries each performance so strongly. If you're not really familiar with him, please give me a second to give you a mini bio. So Markham is an extremely popular and easily recognizable character actor. A neat bit of trivia that I found out about Monty is that he was actually class president when he graduated from Palm Beach High School in 1953. His classmate was Burt Reynolds, who was a year behind him. And Monty would go on to get a master's degree in English Literature and Theater from the University of Florida. He made his television debut on Mission Impossible in 1966, but before appearing on film or television, he'd been in over 150 plays. One of the places he performed was the Pasadena Playhouse, but the earliest theater credit I could find for him was a notice I came across from February of 1964, where Markham was the lead in a production of something called The Defense of Taipei, which was held in San Francisco. Variety reviewed it. They didn't love it, but they did write, quote, "Monty Markham stands out strongly, although he is a victim of the most unreal lines of any character," end quote. Markham actually got into film and TV later than most actors do because he wanted to learn his craft in the theater first. In an interview he gave to Mel Hymer in 1967, Markham said, quote, "Dig your well as deep as you can because you're going to be drawing from it for the rest of your life," end quote. And during the time he was working primarily in theater, Markham also taught acting in places such as Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri. So he was heavily ensconced in his craft, even at this very early stage. But I think the most important thing I got from reading all the stuff about Monty Markham was that he did not look down on television at all. He believed it was the actor's job to take any role he could and bring quality to the performance, which I love, and which he did. He found note for himself when he was cast in two parts in a sitcom titled The Second Hundred Years. I think that was the late 60s. The series did not do well and was canceled after one season. I'll just read the synopsis off IMDb because it confuses me, and maybe you know it better. IMDb has "The Misadventures of a Man Who Is Revived Out of Decades of Accidental Suspended Animation and Is Still Physically Half the Age of His Own Son and Matches the Age of His Grandson."
It's a very special season on ABC.
Your father's alive.
He can't be. He was frozen 67 years ago.
He melted. Now, a man who's been on ice, so to speak, for 67 years, well, he's got some catching up to do.
By God, there's a midget in that box.
Well, not bad for 101.
Oh, wait, what language are you talking?
That's a new language called 1967.
Is that a part of the language?
That's very much a part.
Let's go, son.
Life and laughs begin with The Second Hundred Years in color on ABC.
It didn't do very well in the ratings, but Markham did get good reviews, and this led him to a series of one-off roles on episodic television. He also appeared in another short-lived series, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, but in 1973, he landed the lead in the controversial reboot of Perry Mason, which I think is a better show than it gets credit for. At the time he was cast, he was starring alongside Debbie Reynolds on Broadway in a play called Irene, for which I believe he had to leave production so he could work on the series. Now, according to the Perry Mason press releases that came out in 73, Markham was chosen over 250 potential candidates for the role. And Raymond Burr told the press that he thought Monty Markham was a good actor, and he wished him well on the series. Now, Burr couldn't do Perry Mason if he wanted to, because he was currently starring in Ironside when Perry Mason got the reboot. So, the reviews of the series, not very kind, although most said it wasn't so much Markham, who they all seemed to enjoy, but that it was just that Burr was too synonymous with the role of Perry Mason. Yeah, it's understandable. I still think Markham's pretty good, and I enjoy the show myself. And it's probably worth noting that Markham's TV movie career was pretty good. In particular, the 1971 adaptation of Death Takes a Holiday is my favorite, I think, of all the things I've seen that he's done. Now, we did cover that movie on our main podcast, so I won't go into it too much, except to say that Monty had said that starring in Death was actually his favorite role to date. And I have to say, it's probably one of the best television movies from that era. It was my introduction to him, I believe. And I think his performance in that really captures the depth of Markham's talent. Now, he was really great at comedy, too, but I really love him as, like, this very serious romantic lead type, which I don't know he did a ton of, but in Death Takes a Holiday, he's really, like, very hunky, and he's very somber and sober, but it's a really lovely performance, and it's a really lovely film, and one I feel like I want to sit and watch again right now, just talking about it. I think the subject matter is handled really well, and I think it's poignant, and I think it's important to bring up now because it is a movie about death, right? And it's perfectly themed here because the Trap Cast talks about how Trapper John is about potentially facing death and doing it with some sort of understanding of it. I don't think that Death Takes a Holiday brings a lightheartedness to it, but it does bring something that helps you with closure. And I think that maybe Trapper John isn't really seeking to do that, but I think there's an idea of that somewhere in the subtext. So anyway, Markham was in a couple of other really good TV movies from this era, including The Astronaut and something called Visions, which also starred Telly Savalas. That's very good. When I do my TV movie lectures, I often talk about The Astronaut because I think it's a perfect blueprint of the types of domestic themes that the TV movie was seeking to explore. It's probably not my favorite TV movie, but I think it's a really important one, and I think Money Markham's really great in it. Again, playing the romantic lead, so maybe I'm wrong about him not being the romantic lead. Maybe I just need to watch more of his stuff, which I will do gladly, guys. He would continue to work on episodic TV. I guess he's most recognizable to people my age for playing Blanche's gay brother Clayton on The Golden Girls, or for his incredibly dark turn as Allison's lecherous father on Melrose Place, which I just rewatched those episodes and I couldn't believe it was him. It was so upsetting. Oh, he's so good in that, though. He also had recurring roles on Baywatch, you may remember, and he was also on Dallas, where he played Sue Ellen's love interest Clint for a while. He's just really versatile. Like I said, he can handle both drama and comedy adeptly. I adore him, and I love that he's still working. Love is a Three-Way Street was written by one of the creators of Trapper John, Don Brinkley. I may have mentioned him in the first episode of the show. He was, of course, behind Medical Center, which I remember saying had a stronger kinship with the series than MASH actually did. Anyway, it's just a big thumbs up for Love is a Three-Way Street. Lots of fun, and yay for more Jackpot! Shattered Image originally aired on October 28, 1979, and I'll just start with the IMDb synopsis because it's kind of funny to me. So basically, the IMDb synopsis goes, a wealthy socialite injured in a car accident tries to cover up the fact that she has no real friends by sending herself flowers and gifts. You know what? That's going to fill 45 minutes, isn't it? But that's generally the gist of the episode. So basically, it's about this super rich lady named Claudia, played with a lot of fun by the wonderful Celeste Holm. She's injured in a car accident, and they bring her into the hospital. And of course, Dr. Riverside sees her. She's a little famous in San Francisco. So what does he do? He hits on her. But it's really cute. It is.
Madam, those jewels should be in the hospital safe.
Over my dead body.
Good Lord. You're
Claudia Arrowsmith, yes.
Yes, you were the chairperson at the celebrity golf tournament for leukemia at my club.
Please, chair lady. I don't like the idea of being desexed.
Dear lady, if you were the patient, I would...
What would you?
Take Mrs. Arrowsmith to room 5 immediately. Why aren't you in uniform?
Never mind, doctor. Just deposit me in Lost and Found.
Room 5 at once.
And while she's waiting to be carried into emergency, Gonzo enlists the help of a young woman named Lauren, who's played by Shelley Long. Lauren had just applied for a job to be a nurse's aide, but didn't have the reference to go with her application. And so as she was on her way home, she was feeling pretty dejected, but Gonzo thought she handled herself really well and offers to give her the recommendation she needs so desperately. Of course, this raises numerous of concerns with Trapper, even though this is pretty much exactly how we hired Gonzo, right? So the only difference is that we got that glorious shower scene with Gonzo, you know. We didn't get that one with Shelley Long. Sorry, guys. So anyway, if you remember from the pilot, Dr. Riverside show some concern as well, and all three doctors are quickly informed that Lauren lied about her job at a place called St. Anne's. She actually learned to be a nurse's aide at a correctional facility where she was doing time for armed robbery, which is a pretty big secret to be keeping.
Okay, Lauren, you want to tell us about St. Catherine's?
Am I fired?
Okay, if I ask the questions.
Why?
You know all the answers. That's why I'm here, right?
Wrong.
I never worked at St. Catherine's.
Where did you work?
The prison hospital. I lied on my application. I get paid for the hours I put in.
Lauren, would you please quit trying to fire yourself?
Why? So you can have the fun of catching me in every lie?
Lauren, we would like to keep you on, but you're not making it easy for us.
I applied for work at 6 other places. This is the 7th. At the other 6, I told the truth. That's not what they wanted. Sorry, the position's filled. If anything comes up, all I wanted was a chance. Just a chance to show what I could do. After 2 years of doing time, I thought I could start clean. Well, it's a real laugh. What I really got was a life sentence.
So while all of this chaos with Lauren is unfolding, Claudia is demanding that she be given a bigger room to make way for all the flowers, gifts, and visitors that are to come. She isn't really visited by anybody except her secretary, Alma, who's played by Patricia Smith. Alma is kind of a straight shooter, and she informs Claudia and the audience that Claudia spent too much time being generous with the wrong people. When she's not shelling out dough to these gold diggers or throwing a big fancy party, these people couldn't be bothered. And that honesty gets Alma fired.
That's it?
That's it.
What have you been telling people?
Well, a lot of them weren't home. I left some messages.
I don't believe you. Unless you've been making my situation seem unimportant.
Oh, Claudia, I've been trying to tell you for years. These dear friends of yours, you bought them all with the fancy parties and the expensive little gifts. They're not friends you can count on. They come and they eat your food and they drink your drinks, but they're not around when you need them.
I think you should leave.
Oh, Claudia, you're getting old enough to face a few facts.
Get out of this room. Get out of my life. I'll mail you your severance pay.
Don't you want me to wait till you are back on your feet?
Why? You think I need you? I don't need anyone. Except perhaps an occasional husband for a change of pace. As far as I'm concerned, you're through.
So while Lauren is placed on probation and is pretty sure it's the end for her, Claudia offers her a job as her secretary. But Gonzo is determined to keep Lauren on staff. When a flabbergasted Lauren asks Gonzo why, he just simply says, maybe it's because I like you.
Hey, wait a minute. Look, I think we can fix this.
My lawyer said, don't...
Until the board meets, you just keep doing what you're supposed to do. If Riverside gives you any problems, you come to me.
Who are you kidding? I've been through this charade. I know I'm out.
You are not out. We're trying to prevent that.
Hey, why are you sticking your neck out for me? What's in it for you?
Because maybe I like you. Did you ever think of that?
And then the great crush of 1979 begins, which puts Gonzo in this pretty awkward position, and maybe the audience too, because Gonzo sleeps around a lot already, right? And is he not having sex with her because she's a criminal? Maybe. But he's decided to friend zone this woman, and as you can guess, it doesn't go over that well. I feel her. But wait, there's more. Claudia has been wearing this very expensive brooch on her robe in the hospital, as you do, and it turns up missing. Dr. Riverside, of course, accuses Lauren, and you don't need 3D glasses to see that big chip growing on her shoulder. So, she's been friend-zoned, she's been accused of robbery, she's basically the punching bag of this episode. But it's still handled with a light touch, and the standout here really is Shelley Long, who puts in a really amazing performance as the vulnerable but jaded Lauren. I really feel for her through the entire episode, and it's such a great contrast to her character Diane from Cheers. And you know what, I just think Shelley Long's really lovely. She's great in everything, and I think this is a good way to look at how varied her career was in these early days. But, you know, there's not much to this episode. It's good. But I feel like maybe it's a bit more of a throwaway than Love is a Three-Way Street. But I guess, as I said earlier, this is about the guest stars. Celeste Holm is really a lot of fun. She's a scenery chewer. And while she's an Oscar-winning actress and probably most famous for her classic film work, I always remember her best in the Columbo episode Old Fashioned Murder, which featured another great, of course, Joyce Van Patten as the bad guy. If memory serves, Celeste's character has a serious case of the vapors and was absolutely hilarious in that episode. And like Monty Markham, she was working in theater before she moved over into film. She was nominated 3 times for Oscars, winning a Best Supporting Character statue for 1947's Gentleman's Agreement. And like Monty, she did a heck of a lot of episodic TV, appearing in everything from The Name of the Game to The Streets of San Francisco to Matt Houston to an episode of Cheers where she played Woody's grandmother. Unfortunately, this came during the Kirstie Alley years, so no reunion for Shelley and Celeste. But anyway, this one is solid and I really like it. But since we're loving on Celeste, and before I end the episode, I wanted to mention a project I'm working on. So, Celeste was also nominated for Emmy Awards, including one in 1968 for appearing in the Inside episode Fat Hands and a Diamond Ring. So, over on my blog, I started to write capsule reviews of some Inside episodes, but I kind of got waylaid by my life, as happens sometimes. And if you're not familiar with Insight, it was this religious-based anthology show that lasted 2 freaking decades. The right holders, I believe they're called Paulus Productions, have uploaded a ton of episodes onto YouTube, and so I started covering them. I'm hoping to get back to it. I'm not sure the one Celeste appears in is online yet or will appear online, but there's still a lot to love over there, especially if you're a fan of Trapper structure, because Insight is all about famous faces, and you'll see everyone from Jack Klugman to James Ferentino to Marie McCormick to Bruce Davidson. Everyone was on it. It's a great show. Go on YouTube and check it out. Oh, yeah, briefly, I wanted to mention that this episode was directed by Corey Allen, who directed Celeste and a couple of other things. They worked together in an episode of Lucan titled You Can't Have My Baby. And Allen also directed Celeste in a 1989 episode of CBS Summer Playhouse that was titled Roadshow, which also starred Lee Majors. And I better stop here before I get carried away with Lucan or Lee Majors, because that's a whole other podcast, isn't it? And OMG, guys, we finally got some feedback. I say finally, 3 episodes, and that's really amazing. And I just want to go ahead and play it. This is our friend Stan Peel.
Hey, Amanda. This is my feedback for Love is a Three-Way Street. Jackpot's friend Polo is a classic middle-class white guy gang member, like straight out of West Side Story, complete with a squeaky clean gang hangout. I feel like we saw this kind of sanitized, whitewashed gangster throughout the 60s and 70s, and I would have hoped that they would have been more progressive and realistic by 79. On the other hand, he is so clearly inept. Obviously there for comic relief. Maybe the show's creators were in on the joke, but still, it's hard to believe that he could manage stealing the Titanic. Now, Monty Markham's Harry Beaumont reminds me of Don Galloway's character, Richard, in The Big Chill. He's big and boisterous and obviously so clearly out of place. A good casting choice. I personally didn't like him, but I don't think I was supposed to. Now, I'm really interested in how they handle life after divorce here in this episode. It not only says good things about Trapper's character, but I think it makes a statement about the acceptance of divorce in general at the time. And I guess it's a reflection of the progress that's being made late in the decade, but on the other hand, kind of at the same time, there seems to be a subtle anti-divorce message. Like, Trap and Melanie belong together in spite of going through the formality of a divorce. Now, I never watched the full series, so I'm really curious to see where their relationship goes, if anywhere. Okay, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here. I know I need to let this go, but the timelines for Trapper and Melanie just don't quite work here. It's mentioned that they've been together for 28 years, which would put their marriage at about 1951. Now, that barely puts Trapper and Korea in time for the war to end. MASH timelines are notoriously wonky, and this is, you can't see me, but I'm putting on my nerd glasses here. Given that Trapper was replaced by BJ, he had to go home at least sometime in 1950. Not to mention, at least according to events in MASH, Trapper's daughters were at least old enough to understand and respond to something like getting an adopted Korean brother, which, by the way, didn't happen at the last minute. That's another story. So at least according to MASH, Melanie, who's named Louise on MASH, and Trapper had to get married no later than 1947, according to MASH, but probably earlier, really, which would make their relationship not 28, but like 33, 34, 35 years by this episode. And I know that's nitpicky, and I know that part of the reason is that the actors just don't look old enough to have been married that long. Jessica Walter, who plays Melanie, is only 38 when they did the episode, and at 51, Purnell Roberts was only, he would have only been 21 or 22 during the Korean War. So obviously, they had to minimize the timeline, and I have to learn to suspend my disbelief. I don't know if I can, but I'm gonna try. Okay, the Shattered Image episode of Trapper John was amazing. I was so happy to see Shelley Long. Now, weirdly enough, I had just seen her on MASH in a post-Trapper episode as one of Hawkeye's unfortunate dates. He was trying to quit drinking. It didn't go well. That episode of MASH didn't really test her range. She was a lot like Diane from Cheers. But the Trapper episode, the Shattered Image, showed a wonderful dark side that we really don't usually get to see from Shelley Long. I thought she did a beautiful job as an ex-con trying to get it right. Actually, she played a very particular and an all-too-common type of female con, somebody who followed her boyfriend into trouble. Prisons are full of women who are otherwise good people, but put too much faith in a guy with bad intentions. And she seemed to fit right into that mold, and Gonzo had the right sense to help her. Now, I have to say, though, she disappointed me late in the episode, and by that I mean the writers disappointed me. It seemed like her evolution was all about being appreciated for what she had to offer as a nurse, regardless of her past. And it seemed important to establish herself as an accomplished woman who could think and act for herself, but then she was all of a sudden about Gonzo being in love with her in this one scene, which she did admirably, by the way. It was, like I say, it's the writers, not Shelley Long. She did what she could with that particular scene, but it was really disempowering for her to suddenly just be wrapped up in another man. And now, I suppose that's part of the profile of the character I was talking about, and that's how she was introduced, but she just seemed stronger than that. And at the end, by the final scene, she did seem to have grown in that direction. Now, Claudia's story is incredibly moving. It's simple but effective, and Celeste Holm was so delightful. She was just awesome. And seeing amazing actors like her and Purnell Roberts together in scenes really elevated the whole episode. I loved when it was just the two of them in a scene. And I love the past that they hinted at, but never fully explained. And when she had that final scene with Alma, it was just so moving. It was beautiful. That's all, except I just have to add, as a person with acrophobia, I continue to struggle with the ending scenes that are on the roof of the Titanic. Everybody, in this episode in particular, everybody was just standing up there at the end. Do they know there are no safety rails? I think it's just, where's the actors' union? What's going on here? That's it. Thanks for letting me add my two cents.
So, Stan, I made a bunch of notes here about things you talked about, but as I was making them, I kind of realized that there's nothing to comment on, but I want to thank you so much for going more in depth to the Shattered Image than I did. I think I noticed in the last episode what I'm kind of doing is I'm taking an episode of the two that I kind of prefer, and I'm going more into it, and then maybe I'm not doing justice to the other episode. So we had kind of different thoughts, I think, about Shattered Image and Love is a Three-Way Street. I think we both enjoyed both, but I enjoyed Love is a Three-Way Street, I think, a little more than you did, and you enjoyed Shattered Image a little more than I did. So thank you for talking so much about it and for going into the Shelley Long stuff. Now, I'd forgotten she had appeared on MASH, so thank you so much for bringing that up, and I need to be more hyper aware of looking for the guest stars and seeing if they've appeared on MASH because, I mean, this is supposed to be a MASH spinoff, right? But I think you're right that the writers do kind of take a turn with her, because it is really about her trying to get out of that shadow of her criminal record. And then it becomes about, well, God, Gonzo's really cute. And I mean, trust me, I understand. But we're kind of losing the script there, literally. So yeah, that's a little unfortunate. And I kind of think that there's going to be some Trapper Johns that feel jumpy, like Jump the Sharky, I think is what I want to say, just within that episode. And also Jump the Shark within the series, right? Because you're right about the timelines. And it's just, I guess, because I got into both shows when I was so young, I wasn't really thinking about either one that way. So I don't necessarily mind it, but it is kind of funny to think about Jessica Walter only being 38 and God knows whatever. And I didn't actually realize that the age differences were so great because Jessica Walter's always looked kind of like 42 to me. Beautiful. Beautiful. And when I say 42, that's not supposed to be a strike against her. She just had a very mature look to her. And she still looks 42. You know what I mean? It's just like she always looked that age. And so I didn't realize that there was like a 13-year difference between them. But they both play off each other beautifully. And they are a highlight for me in these early episodes. I can't honestly remember where Melanie goes with the series at this point. I don't feel like it goes too much farther than what we see here. Although there is a Melanie-centric episode coming up, I just can't remember so much past like the first handful of episodes. Anyway, hopefully you'll stick around and we can find out what becomes of her. And thanks so much for your feedback. I really appreciate it. And again, if you want to contact me, just email me at tvmayhempodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much, Dan. So I think that's just it for me today. A little brief, quick episode here. I will tell you the next two episodes we're covering are What Are Friends For? And One More For My Baby. Oh, I wanted to give you a trap fact. So let me tell you a little trivia about Titanic and the parking lot scenes. These scenes were apparently shot in Los Angeles at the Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital, which is now known as the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center, and previously known as Queen of Angels, the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center. That's located on Vermont Avenue near Sunset Boulevard. And in case you were wondering, it was built in 1924. Thank you so much for listening, and hopefully you won't have to hold on as long to get to another episode. Fingers crossed. Thank you, and goodbye. ¶¶